No, I don't care, I'm doing fine in the race to the bottom line.
One more time.
I don't care, I'm doing fine in the race to the bottom line. No, I don't care, I'm doing fine in the race to the bottom line.
Granny D. I'm talking from KBOO, Portland. I come from Dublin, New Hampshire, and I go across the country working for public funding at the state level. And I often hear about KBOO on my email. It is often mentioned as one of the most progressive and daring stations that we have in this country. They are not afraid to tell you the truth. So tune in to KBOO Portland and get the real word.
KBOO's Metal Marathon, the Metal March, is back once again. And that means brand new metal merch. Go to kboo.fm/metal to check out all KBOO's new metal merch featuring exclusive artwork provided by local artist and musician at Unicron Artworks. This year's Metal Marathon is live on KBOO Friday, March 14th at 8 p.m. through Saturday, March 15th at 6 a.m. Get your very own limited edition 2025 Metal March metal merch and listen to every installment of the Metal Marathon at kboo.fm/metal and support metal on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
Welcome to KBOO.
Michael Van Cleek here, Vice President of the KBOO Board of Directors. KBOO's board is recruiting directors. KBOO's nominating committee is holding virtual information sessions from now through June. All KBOO community members are eligible for board election. Black, Indigenous, and people of color are especially encouraged to apply. Come join us. KBOO's Board of Directors guides the station's strategic plan and represents the interests and visions of our members. More information and meeting times can be found at kboo.fm/boardrecruiting. One word. Thank you for considering board service for KBOO Community Radio.
Show me your moves, baby, what it's.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Y'all ready for this?
Ladies and gentlemen.
Hello, everyone. This is Free Will and Franklin jumping in on Hard Knock Radio today. And last Friday, March 28th, former Contra Costa County Sheriff Andrew Hall was quietly released from San Quentin prison after serving less than half of his 6-year sentence. Hall shot and killed Danville resident Vladimir Arboleda in 2019, but it wasn't until after shooting and killing another Danville man, Tyrell Wilson, in 2021, that charges were brought against Hall for his prior shooting. Hall is the first officer in the county to be convicted, and following the 2022 judgment, Sheriff Coroner Livingston, who is the sheriff of Contra Costa County, expressed his continued support for Officer Hall and expressed disapproval of his sentencing and conviction. Well, in opposition to the early release of Andrew Hall, families of his victims, their loved ones, and their supporters held a press conference and rally in front of the Contra Costa County Sheriff's Office in Martinez. Coming up next, we'll share some voices from the press conference, including the family of Vladimir Arboleda, Jennifer Leung Arboleda, that's Vladimir's sister. We'll also hear from the family of Angelo Quinto, that's Bella Quinto Collins, Angelo's sister, and Robert Collins, Angelo's father. And we'll hear from Gigi Crowder, who's the CEO of NAMI Contra Costa.
Hello, everybody. I'm Bella Quinto Collins, sister of Angelo Quinto, who was killed by Antioch police in Antioch in December of 2020 during a mental health crisis. But we're here today to protest the early release, which we've just been notified has happened already, of former Deputy Sheriff Andrew Hall, who was responsible for killing two people in just a short time frame. We have the family of Vladimir Arboleda here, and we have a picture of him here. This is Jennifer Leung, his sister. And then we're also here to lift up Tyrell Wilson. Charges were brought against Hall shortly after killing the second person, Tyrell Wilson. And Sheriff Coroner David Livingston initially cleared Hall of any wrongdoing in the shooting death of Vladimir Arboleda, which led to him being put back on the streets and enabled him to kill another person. So. Today, we're speaking up also because this was a historic conviction in Contra Costa County. For the first time, an officer was convicted of killing an individual. One of two, but we took what we got. He was sentenced to 6 years, and he was set to serve 85% of that sentence, or 5.1 years, before being eligible for parole. But recently, Jennifer, Vladimir's sister, was the only person notified that he was being scheduled for an early release today. And so the DA confirmed that today he was released from San Quentin, and it's just completely outrageous. It's a complete slap in the face to all of these families, to all of our families, to the community. This was such a public-facing crime. There's no reason that it should have been kept under wraps. He's only served less than half of his sentence. There's no reason that this should have happened. So I think I'll invite Jennifer to speak if you feel comfortable. Yeah, anything.
So I just found out, actually, just today that it is true. The DA confirmed that he has been released. And I just want to know why my mother wasn't notified. How come we weren't notified? How come he didn't serve at least his 85% time in jail that he's supposed to? He was convicted in a jury. He is a convicted felon. And why is he has this special treatment? Why? And we still have no answers. So I'm here to try to ask our sheriff why, and to give us some answers. If you can tell me or my mother, why is he out without my mother being notified? And this is devastating.
A major concern is everyone on this poster lived with mental illness. And so basically, we recognize that individuals who live with mental illness are more likely to be harmed by those hired to protect and serve them. But this sends a message to family members that when they are killed by law enforcement, the penalties are not as severe as they should be. Two individuals killed while living with a mental health challenge, and I will share that Tyrell Wilson was not experiencing any type of psychosis at the time he was killed. We have Hall, who had already had many incidents of community members complaining about him. But guess what happens? When you get away with murder, it makes you feel like you can do it again. And so he was only convicted after the second killing, but not for Tyrell. So of course his family's very upset that the charges were not filed. History was made when he got 6 years. So what message are we now sending to family members about the value of those who live with mental illness when you can get away with killing two people and only serve 3 years? That's the reason we know we need to separate the sheriff from the coroner's office. And there's no better family to talk about that than the Quinto Collins family, because they've been very successful with getting one of the excuses that law enforcement uses being debunked. And so I'll move out of the way and just say it's a sad day. Not because, like Sheriff Livingston said, it was a sad day when he went to jail. No, it's a sad day because he's been released.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I'm Robert Collins, Angelo Quinto's dad, here just asking for something really simple. And the ask is that we are supposed to live in a country that abides by rule of law. And here we're seeing a clear example where there's a separate set of rules or laws that are applied to different people. Not everyone is upheld to the same standard. For example, in the records, we cannot find any record of Mr. Hall's early release. None of the hearings appear to be public, or at least they're not in the records that the California Department of Corrections has. We're asking for something very simple, and that is, when we have a convicted felon, he should not be treated differently just because he was a sheriff's deputy before, just as he shouldn't have been treated differently when he committed the first crime and he was not held accountable for it, which led to the second crime, the second homicide, I should say. There's potentially many other crimes. So all we're asking for is we should all live under the same laws in this United States of America. Thanks.
Sorry, I'll come back to speak a little bit more on why the separation of the sheriff coroner is necessary. Yes, as we've heard in this case, Sheriff Coroner David Livingston, he released a letter in support of Hall and with contempt for his sentencing and subsequent conviction back in 2022 after the historic conviction. He said, "I got your back." He said it to every single sheriff, deputy, and officer in there. And there is no doubt in our minds that he stands by that support. It is him as well as Andrew Hall who has blood on their hands. I guess tying it also a little bit more to other cases, in our case, the case of Angelo Quinto, the autopsy conducted by a quasi-independent medical examiner found him to be dead by something called excited delirium, which we have since outlawed in California.
Yeah.
With AB 360. But the people responsible for taking his autopsy photos were a DA detective and an Antioch police detective. This is not something that should ever be allowed. This is a structural issue that we're seeing here. There's no reason that the sheriff should be the coroner or that he should have this amount of unchecked power, discretion, authority to determine manner of death, to sway cause of death, to release whatever he wants whenever he wants to. Right. And using that power, he supports killers. If anybody has anything to add, that would be great.
I got something to add.
Sure.
This euphemism of excited delirium is the kind of euphemism that kills. There's two things that everybody has. They have a birth certificate and a death certificate. And when you make up a euphemism to hide police killings with the euphemism of excited delirium, I'm glad they finally outlawed it. And it's about bleep time. Thank you.
So just to, you know, Robert, again, I just want to clarify that what we're talking about are structural changes that we need here. What's really happening is that there's an abuse of power by somebody that has power that is unchecked. This is really two sides of the same coin. The sheriff is the coroner, so the sheriff decides why somebody was killed. This is not a function that should be. It should be a scientific function from a doctor, not a political one from a sheriff that is investigating deaths of potentially deputies under his command and or other law enforcement personnel. Likewise, as Bella was saying, it's part of the structural issue of not having checks and balances. The fact that then Deputy Hall was investigated by the same sheriff's office is another conflict of interest. We need independence in investigations. We need that. We need that accountability to begin to trust the process that we have. We have a lack of trust when there is somebody that's killed by law enforcement that the subsequent process will be fair. It can't be fair when we're asking the same people, when an antique police officer was the one taking pictures of Angelo's eyes and they're determining that he died of excited delirium instead of asphyxiation, which is the actual cause of death as it's come out since then. That's because he has an ingrained bias and conflict of interest. So he's going to try to find and hide details that don't adhere to that narrative. So what we're asking for is checks and balances. We're asking for a check on power. And there's nothing more American than a check on power, at least there used to be. The idea was that we have checks and balances and we have a system that you trust but verify. You don't just trust blindly, and no one is above the law. That's how it's supposed to be. Yeah. But this is not what we have today. The early release of former Deputy Hall is significant in how it showcases the fact that it didn't go through the normal process that would apply to anybody else. So what we're asking for is structural reform. Separating the sheriff coroner is one aspect. Having independent investigations is another aspect. And in general, having a process by which the public can trust, because there is some redress for the public when there is a potential conflict of interest. Anything else you want? Oh, right. So just to clarify, the death certificate, as it was pointed out, is this important document. It also is the reason why the DA may look into a death. So the whole point of obscuring a death by saying it's excited delirium or hiding the actual cause of death is so that there's no charges brought against an officer. It's a way to protect the officer. In the case of Angelo's death, they said excited delirium. Why? That was an accident, according to them. There was no human or no homicide, no human that was responsible for his death. And so it begins there. When you don't have the basic data and you can't trust the most important data, like why a person died, it's two things. You can't trust the process, and it also is a great example of how that process is being abused by having too much power with one individual. There's no reason that the sheriff and the coroner, who are the same person, not two different people, the same person throughout California in 48 counties, there's no reason for this. How could you even have the coroner investigate what the sheriff is doing and the sheriff investigate what the coroner is doing? It doesn't make any sense. And so we need that separation, much as we need independent investigations for those reasons.
Yeah. Sorry, I just wanted to highlight again something that Jennifer said that really resonated with me, is that these are lives we're talking about. These families are irreparably damaged, irreparably harmed. There's nothing that could ever be done to make up for what happened to them because of Andrew Hall, because of the sheriff, because of this system. And I think it's really important that we just we remember that and we raise their names. So if everybody could repeat, Latimer Arboleda.
Latimer Arboleda.
Tyrell Wilson.
Tyrell Wilson.
Latimer Arboleda.
Latimer Arboleda.
Tyrell Wilson.
Tyrell Wilson.
And countless others.
And far too often, the individuals who are killed are men of color. All of these are men of color. That happens much more often. And I will say, without a doubt, that partly why Andrew Hall is out is because he's a white man of privilege. And a white man of privilege will get much more leniency than the many men of color that I go to the court systems every day for much less harmful crimes, who spend many more years in jail for victimless crimes. So someone to get 3 years who killed two people, when I work every day to get individuals off for violations of parole and things like that, for drug charges, we already know we're in a county that has violated the Racial Justice Act. So I'm also very disappointed that he's getting leniency because of his white skin privilege.
Yeah.
Thank you for coming out. I think that's all.
All right, Free Will and Franklin, behind the camera here. The rally has just wrapped up, and we are here with Latimer Arboleda's sister, Jennifer Arboleda Leong. And first of all, I'm so sorry that this happened and that you had to find out in this way. Tell us again, just so people know, how you were informed that Andrew Hall was getting out today.
Originally, well, it was by email, and I received a letter, and it was just only me. My mother, who was not notified at all. And coming here this morning, I confirmed that the DA confirmed that he was indeed released. We tried calling, trying to get answers. We keep getting the runaround, no callback. And still now, we're still waiting for some answers.
And was there supposed to be some sort of process where you thought you might be able to come out if he was going to be paroled and give another like victim impact statement or something, as people often do during parole? Why should he be released now? Has he been a good prisoner? All that stuff. And so just kind of tell me how you felt when you received that letter and that email.
Oh, I'm still in shock, actually. To tell you the truth, I am in shock. It is just devastating for the family and for my mother. It's devastating. I mean, my brother was shot 9 times. Andrew Hall was convicted by a jury. He's supposed to spend 6 years in jail. It's less than 2. This is just like another slap in the face to the family.
Do you know if there's any recourse? Are you all going to be speaking with the DA or anybody? I mean, where do you go from here?
Still waiting for answers. Always still waiting for answers. No one. They said that they were going to send a representative out of the coroner's office, and still nobody. They closed the parking lots. Still nothing.
Okay, and so you don't even know what to do if there's even a process involved.
No, we don't. We don't know. I'm thankful that I have NAMI of Contra Costa helping, the Angelo Quinto Collins Foundation, the Miles Hall Foundation. I mean, really, they've been really a strong support with us. So.
All right, well, we'll keep an eye on this, and we'll see if there's any recourse for you in the future, and hopefully, you know, maybe you could see him return back to jail to serve out his time like the rest of the population has to do.
Correct, yes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, and still wrapping up the rally here, the press conference. Now we are joined by Gigi Crowder of NAMI Contra Costa. And Gigi, we kind of heard here that this was unexpected. There was no process where we, the community, got to learn about this. You know, how do you feel as someone that deals with folks that have been impacted by mental health crises when they just kind of dump this news on you again without any sort of warning, you know?
Yeah. It's really unfortunate that we live in a county that does not respect the fact that most of us are already traumatized by what's happening nationally. So to have this layer of, we've now released early someone who killed two people who live with mental illness, I already started getting the phone calls from individuals who were asking us, is that true? Is it possible? We know that at NAMI, family members watch the news closely. They were already frightened to call law enforcement. It's going to increase their anxiety knowing that someone like Andrew Hall was released early. Can he work as a law enforcement again? No, but what message is it sending to others who are in that field of work? That you can kind of get away with murder. 3 years? It should have been much more than that. And I spend a lot of time in court with people who have done much less and get much more time. So the level of white supremacy and racism in this county sickens me. So whenever we try and do something to remind people of why some communities suffer more mental illness, we get slapped in the face again. For me, this is a slap in the face to BIPOC community members because it's saying we value the life of a crooked cop over those who live with mental illness.
And I just asked Jennifer if she knows any sort of recourse or anything that she could do as a family member to see that he tries to serve out his time, or is just the end game, or what do we know about why he got out so early and what was the deal?
I think all county departments work in cahoots with each other. There's no way in the world that the DA didn't know, that other parts of the county didn't know. They work all together. It's very secretive. It probably was a mistake that Jennifer got the information. Some clerk probably sent it and was told, oh no, you weren't supposed. When she got it in December and she sent it to me, I said, oh, we got to mobilize. And then I said, let's start trying to figure out if this is even true. Because part of you want to believe they wouldn't do that, right? You're always like, oh, they wouldn't do that. But the reality is they're going to do what's in their best interest. And it's usually not in the best interest of those who are impacted by mental illness, those who are from BIPOC communities, or those who really care about fairness in our government. They're going to work together. They're going to do things trickery. And I've just seen it happen over and over again. But I think we're at a time now where we can have movements around solidarity. And it shouldn't be just the people impacted who show up. It should be the people who know that they're also at risk. And with who we have in government now, all of us are at risk. Because he's talking about qualified immunity for law enforcement. There really was no consequence besides one or two for the folks who brutalized people in Antioch. So I'm not one of those people who ever get surprised about things like that. I'm shocked when things work the way we want to work them. But we have a God, right? And so that makes me feel like even today, even though they're not going to go rearrest Hall because we and the family's upset about it, but we showed up today to say we're not happy about it. And I think that's how we maintain our mental wellness. When we speak out against brutality, terrorism, and all of that, then we start feeling better because we use our voice instead of remaining voiceless. And there's been times when things have happened and we've been voiceless. So at least we're lifting our voice. So thank you.
Definitely. I feel the same way. A lot of times you want to grow that that bubble of hope, but you have to be prepared for it not to happen.
Right. And then even though you know it's likely not going to happen, you look for the gaps and the opportunities where that's going to happen. They're going to do what they do. But what can we do in response to that gets us a little closer to the end goal, which is separating the coroner from the sheriff? I believe it can happen. I believe it will happen. I don't know if it happened, you know, while I'm still working at NAMI Contra Costa, but even if I'm retired, I will come back and join a movement like that. Yeah.
All right, Gigi Crowder, thank you very much.
Thanks.
All right, and again, wrapping up with the rally and the press conference, I'm joined here by Bella Quinto Collins, who's going to kind of bring us a little more information on the separation of the sheriff and the coroner. So what are you all doing as a family now to try and separate the sheriff and the coroner? I know you had a state bill or something last year or the year before that almost made it but didn't. Tell us about that effort and what's your renewed effort look like these days?
So we had AB 1608 previously, which made it past the assembly floor and all of the committees, as well as appropriations. It was found to be of no significant cost to the state. And it died at the Senate floor after the Sheriff's Association opposed it. And what we have been working on now is just on a smaller scale, trying to make sure that we can educate people about why there needs to be a separation. I think a lot of people are not aware that the sheriff in this county, as well as in 48 out of 58 of the California counties, is the actual coroner. He's not conducting any autopsies. He has no qualifications to do so, but he is contracting out to people to do so. And those people are getting all of their employment from this sheriff coroner. So there's not really an independence there that they claim there is. But today, part of the poll here is that not only did you have a former sheriff's deputy who killed two people, the only reason that he was able to kill the second person before charges were announced for the first killing was because Sheriff Coroner David Livingston cleared him of any wrongdoing, failed to find that he broke any policy or laws in the first place. That put him back on the streets, put him back with a gun in his hands, and allowed Tyrell Wilson to be unjustly killed as well. And not only that, after the historic conviction of Andrew Hall, Sheriff Coroner David Livingston also sent out a wide letter of support, public support, for Andrew Hall, for his actions and inactions, as well as really criticizing the DA and judge for sentencing and convicting Andrew Hall in the first place. So we are seeing very, very clearly why there needs to be a separation, why there needs to be independence, because clearly in this case, I guess I can't stress it enough, it can't really be any clearer than this. The sheriff is very supportive of a killer, very supportive of a killer, finds him to be justified, and that has impacts far beyond putting others on the street who will kill. It has impacts far beyond officers getting special treatment in convictions of heinous crimes. For one thing, in the case of my brother Angelo Quinto, his autopsy was conducted by what is supposedly an independent pathologist, but who, again, only got his employment from the sheriff's office through being contracted. And in the autopsy room, the only people taking photos of my brother, of his eyes, of all of his body, were a DA's detective and an Antioch police detective. It's just really built into the structure that there is no independence, there's no ability for there to be an unbiased investigation into deaths like these or deaths that aren't like these, deaths that don't involve police or deputy sheriffs. That was a mouthful.
Can I ask you, have they explained, I know someone was supposed to come out and say something today, but have they explained why they want to hang on to this ability? What is important for them to be able to be in this dual role? Have they ever expressed that to you, or what have you learned?
I think in pursuing legislation like 1608, we've learned that the arguments made most commonly are that a separation of the offices, the bodies, would be costly, and it takes away the discretion of Board of Supervisors to make that decision. But the thing is, it really fails to acknowledge that there is funding that is going to the coroner that is being used for the sheriff's purposes. There is a political body, as my dad always says, that has been given the unchecked power and authority here, when there should be a medical body, for example, or there should be physicians' autonomy. What we saw in the case of, you know, San Joaquin County, for example, should not have to happen again in order for there to be a separation. But it seems like that's the only way to make it happen so far.
Kind of tell us what happened in San Joaquin County for those that don't know.
Yes. In San Joaquin County in 2017, Dr. Bennett Amalu, as well as another pathologist, documented 9 months or so of the sheriff of San Joaquin County influencing cause of death determinations and doing other things to bias the findings. And it took their very public resignation and revealing that documentation to put enough pressure on the DA and the public to get the sheriff's office separated from the coroner so that he could no longer have that power to abuse.
Well, if people want to learn more about separating the sheriff and the coroner, can people follow your social media, or where could they go at least to follow you all in your battle for this?
Yes. So you can follow Justice for Angelo Quinto on Instagram, as well as our Facebook group. We're also working closely with NAMI Contra Costa in this. So if you follow NAMI Contra Costa, that's the National Alliance on Mental Illness Contra Costa, we will have more updates there.
All right, Bella, thank you for joining us today and speaking and enlightening us about what's happening with the sheriff and the coroner. And we'll continue to follow as you fight this battle again. And hopefully this time it'll make it all the way.
Yes, thank you.
All right, Free Will and Franklin, back at you here on Hard Knock Radio. You've been listening to a press conference that was held last Friday, March 28th, protesting the early release of former Contra Costa County Sheriff Andrew Hall. Former Officer Hall was quietly released last Friday from San Quentin Prison after serving less than half his 6-year sentence. And just a reminder, if you want to see the video from the press conference, head over to First Voice Media on Facebook, and please share and like the video with your family and friends. All right, Free Will and Franklin, we'll be right back here on Hard Knock Radio.
Hard Knock Radio. We're rocking with Picasso.
What?
And Maya.
Who?
And my last name is Susana. Yeah, yeah.
Bienvenidos y bienvenidas. Welcome to PNA, Poor People's Revolutionary Radio. This is your co-host, Monteado Silencio, con Voces de Migrantes en Resistencia, with formerly houseless poverty scholars, Tiburcio García, and mi carnala Tiny, la poverty scholar.
Yeah, this is PNN, not CNN, people. That's Poor People's Revolutionary Radio. Live and direct from the small part of unpimped, unbought, unsold, untold Mama Earth that the settlers call Oakland and that we know as Ohlone LeSean land.
Vamos, vamos! Estamos y no nos vamos!
Necesitamos que nos ayuden!
Nos está pasando un trauma para todos.
I want to start by saying how traumatic this is.
Muchas familias que tienen sus niños acá en la escuela no se pueden retirar todavía.
Also, we have families here who actually have their children here in the district who can't just pick up and move.
So that rent increase, they don't even know how they're going to do it, from 400 to 1300.
You just heard two of the 200 families who lost their jobs and homes overnight from the California horse racing industry in so-called Palacinton. This is an active struggle right now, and we are working to support them whatever way we can. From Soka Placington to Soka Berkeley, on today's War on the Poor report, we speak with Indigenous leaders, land protector Corina Gold, on the situation happening in Soka Berkeley, where humbly houseless residents are sleeping and being constantly harassed by neighbors on the small part occupied land, the settlers call Ohlone Park. Then we hear the most recent offering of the addiction doula.
Anda y ve, te está esperando, anda y ve, no lo hagas por mí, que al fin y al cabo somos solo amigos. Anda y ve, te veo nerviosa, anda y ve, y que sientas con él lo que en su día tú sentías.
So yeah, relatives, we are here again. Today is a day of her story. The reason that these stories are so important and we need to get them out as far and wide as possible is because our bodies are silenced as houseless people. We are swept like we're trash every day in this occupied land, and we don't matter. I walk in persona as a poverty scholar because I say this revolution isn't about I, it's not about me. My pronoun is we. I'm trying to uninvisibilize every single day these violent acts of war on the poor. Today we are blessed to have some badass warriors in the struggle for liberation of Mama Earth. Because as we always say, Mama Earth is not for sale. So to have a conversation about what's happening in so-called Berkeley, a.k.a. Uchun, where just like all of Occupied Turtle Island, they'll take the names of First Nations peoples and slap them on a street or slap them on a park with absolutely no account for land back, with no account for the First Peoples whose name they did use, and really almost in another act of erasure of the genocide and removal. So here's an example. In Hypocrisy Berkeley, there's a park called, quote, Ohlone Park, which all the Hypocrisy Berkeley residents are very proud of being near and walking their dogs and having their picnics and their play dates. And in that park, there are other residents, because guess what? A lot of us can't afford the lie of rent. And so, yeah, we end up in a tent. There are also multiverse reasons that we're on the street. And so there's some residents who humbly sleep in a tent in this fetishized and occupied Ohlone Park. And they're being harassed. In this case, not by the politricksters and the city gangsters at this moment, but by the hater neighbors, which happens a lot. The war on the poor does not just happen from the state. It comes from the community. So today we want to spend some time talking about that. And to do that, we have the blessing of bringing in Brother Gordon, who was one of the residents. Welcome, Gordon, to Poor People's Radio. And then also from the warrior, the front line of Where Do We Go, formerly known as Where Do We Go Berkeley, we have Ian. Welcome, Ian. And to properly conversate about a park named after the First Peoples, we have the blessing of having one of our sister warriors, a land protector and co-founder of Segorte Land Trust, Karina Gold. Welcome back to Poor People's Radio, Karina. So maybe we could start with you, Gordon. Let listeners and viewers know what is happening in this park with some of your comrades.
From what I can gather from my visits to the park, things have been relatively quiet there recently. Whenever I go to visit, most of the time people are kind of taking it easy, but I do have a couple points of contact. From what I can tell, they have had city workers come by and talk to them about services and what have you, so they are wary that there's potential closure on the horizon. That's something to be cognizant of going forward.
I want to bring in Ian to talk a little bit about the framing and the structural issue going on, because letters that come from a group called the FOOP, Friends of Ohlone Park, the anger and the rage is escalating in these letters every time they send them about the blight and how these folks have to be moved and they're not safe and they want to force the city to remove that community. Ian, can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, the FOOP is an acronym for Friends of Ohlone Park. They're a community group, a coalition, I think, of neighbors, of people who live around the park and who, from what I assume, are meeting and hoping to meet in the best interest of the park from the way that they see it. But Tiny is completely right. We are seeing a lot of messaging coming from them sending out letters and are planning meetings that have the general feeling that they are against the encampment that's there in the park. There's been a protest encampment there since, I want to say, October of last year, when Where Do We Go was starting protest encampments around downtown Berkeley. And that was one of the sites that we had kind of taken over for people to live and to be safe. And so that camp has been there for a long time. In Berkeley, it's really common for us to encounter upset Berkeley citizens who aren't happy about seeing homelessness, who aren't happy about having to be around poverty or anything like that. It seems like they have a lot of misconceptions of who we are and also kind of a misguided way of dealing with what they see as issues by essentially turning on us and blaming impoverished people for their own poverty and fueling a kind of an overall rhetoric that we're seeing in this country, obviously from the politicians, the politricksters, as Tiny calls them, but all the way down to our regular everyday citizens. And so, yeah, pretty much the Friends of Ohlone Park have been putting out these communications saying they're concerned about the encampment. They're trying to blame the encampment for crimes that happen in the area. And just to be clear, there's no crimes being perpetuated by the people at our encampment. Crimes that are happening there have always been happening in Berkeley. This is downtown Berkeley area. But they're kind of scapegoating this group and looking for a way to get them out. This has been a problem for us at all of our encampments in Berkeley. And I think it's well known that Berkeley can host a lot of NIMBYism, but not in my backyardism. It is kind of an overall theme of Berkeley, and it has been for a very long time. I mean, since the 60s, Berkeley has been a pretty conservative place. I think that we have the optics of Berkeley are often that it's a flower child, hippie, leftist, liberal bastion. But when it comes down to it, our government and our residents and everyone are very conservative, and you will often see them doing things like naming a park Ohlone Park because it's trendy, or to don this disguise of liberalism.
Thank you so much, Ian. And it's actually kind of terrifying, the tone behind these letters. It's just escalating this. Let's bring in Karina to give us some perspective.
Thanks, everybody, for their hard work around these issues. I think that one of the things that we can say is that the LaShawn people were the first ones kicked out of Berkeley. We're living in a similar manner that our relatives that are houseless. A long time ago, my ancestors lived in tule huts, but we lived in villages, which now are being called encampments. But when we're talking about village life, we're talking about people that care for one another, that have similar goals and ideals and how to work together. And I really believe that that's what folks that are living in these encampments are doing. It's interesting that what is now called Ohlone Park was actually a piece of land that BART is actually leasing from the city of Berkeley for $1 a year. So the BART actually runs under there. And so I think that it's important to know that this land that was taken over by BART to create its structure actually has a history of radicalism that we don't talk about. So here we are talking about this NIMBY, but it was actually people from Berkeley that kind of took over this land by planting there after Bloody Thursday at People's Park. And so this was actually People's Park Annex. So it comes from this revolutionary idea in Berkeley at that time in 1969. And now we're talking about land back, and we're talking about NIMBYism, but also how does NIMBYism look in this particular time in the world and in this country when we're looking at fascism? I always say that Nazi Germany took its playbook from the United States and how it treated its indigenous people. But now America is taking that playbook back and is using it on marginalized people, people that are houseless, people that are LGBTQ, people that are migrants. And they're using that same kind of thing. And what worked for Nazism and for the United States taking over land was that it had its buy-in by its regular citizens. And regular citizens telling on each other, or regular citizens being the police force to continue to do this kind of thing. You know, it makes sense that this group, FOOP, who is treating this park as their extension of their own private property. That's what it's being treated as. And to begin to call authorities on folks that are trying to survive. I always say that capitalism was brought to these lands. It was not created here. Private land ownership was created here. And so poverty was also created here. And in our language, there was no such thing as hunger or homelessness. That was something that was brought here through settler colonialism. And so this is what we're looking at today. We're looking at the extension of the settler colonialism, that capitalism has created this way so that people cannot live with decency, a human right of having a roof over their head, some place to lay their head at night, some place that they can stay warm. And so it is because of that settler colonialism, of land grabs, of all of these things that the United States is built on, that we find ourselves looking at these people that seem like normal citizens having this idea that they can just throw other people away.
Ian, talk a little bit about the struggle in so-called Berkeley.
Yeah, the Civic Center Park encampment. There was a community meeting regarding the Civic Center encampment about 2 weeks ago. A high school student, a Berkeley high school student, was assaulted by a man at Civic Center Park. And pretty much instantly, the Parent Teacher Association and the community at large was up in arms against the encampment and were saying that this man was a member of the camp and that the camp was full of rapists and criminals. This really dangerous rhetoric. People were online saying all these completely untrue things about the people who live there, saying that it's just this band of criminals, essentially putting up the narrative that children are not safe near a homeless encampment. And we hear that a lot.
Wheredowego.org. Support them. Support WoodStreetCommons.org. Support land back to Segorite Land Trust, yes, so that they can create their own parks. Because remember, relatives, this is all occupied Turtle Island. And all of the bay is Ohlone land. Thank you, relatives, so much. Stay tuned after this short music break. We'll be right back.
Next up, y'all are going to be hearing from Leger, the Addiction Doula.
Greetings and abundant risings. This is your Addiction Doula, Leger, on the Holistic Detox and Recovery segment, connecting you to traditional ways to be reborn and liberated from addiction and trauma. Today, we're going to be talking about my own personal recovery journey. I was battling with being heavily addicted to drugs while being unhoused on the streets of Oakland. In June 2023, I began my journey of recovering from 10 years of amphetamine and opiate addiction. My life and future began to be up for examination spiritually, physically, and emotionally. At the time in my treatment facility, I needed to have tools that were more geared to who I was, like being of African descent, needing to be connected to ways of healing without using more pharmaceuticals when I was just coming off of a chemical dependency. So when I completed 90 days, I started working with Essential Food and Medicine in developing a holistic detox and recovery support for others that are looking for alternatives or enhancements to 12-step programs. I'm in the process of stepping into the role as an addiction doula and mentor to offer people tools to support a better and healthy life for themselves. What has been life-changing for me is learning and using traditional ways of healing through spiritual guidance and medicine. With my own journey, I'm using the opportunity to learn different ways to work with healing practices from various indigenous cultures. The purpose is to bring my honest reflection and learning moments and share a holistic approach to recovery. During this segment, I will share my personal experience and different ways of thinking that I've found helpful in building strength in my journey healing from drug addiction. Thank you for listening to your Addiction Doula Leger on the Holistic Detox and Recovery segment, connecting you to traditional ways to be born and liberated from addiction.
And that's all for today's show, y'all. Thank you so much again for listening. This is an active emergency right now regarding the houseless people in the RV camps in Alameda County Fairgrounds. We're doing our best to support the families currently. We're asking people to call the Alameda County Board of Supervisors and the Pleasanton City Council to demand that the families be able to stay on this land for as long as they need to and explore a land trust so they can create their own permanent housing. like we have at Homefulness. For more information, please go to www.poormagazine.org or 48 Hills and read Reparations, Not Evictions.
I need a dollar, 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 that's what I need. Hey, hey. Well, I need a dollar, 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 that's what I need. Hey, hey. Said I need a dollar, 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 that's what I need. And if I share with you my story, would you share your dollar with me?
That's all for this broadcast of Poor People's Radio. You can follow us on Facebook, X, or Instagram, at Poor Magazine, at Poverty Scala. You can also get this complete Poor People's Radio podcast with all the interviews and conversations or any of our previous archive shows on iTunes, Spotify, iHeart, or wherever you get your podcasts. All power to the people.
No roof, no guard. Under the freeway, lost in cold. Somebody's father left out alone. What mother could picture this sight? Her child forgotten, lost to the night. $1 billion homes lying the way. But for him there's no shelter, no place to stay. What happens to us when we fall from grace?
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
Lie down all in the ground, I'd root that mountain down, and I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Tune in to KBOO Monday mornings at 9 for the Old Mole Variety Hour, your source for radically democratic news, views, reviews, and interviews, stories of ordinary and extraordinary people working to root down the oppressive institutions of capitalism. That's the Old Mole Variety Hour, Monday mornings at 9.
This is Bird Note. This staccato call tells us there's a yellow-billed cuckoo nearby, one of two species of cuckoos in the woodlands of North America. The yellow-billed lives in broadleaf forests throughout the East and riparian stands in the Southwest. They were common breeding birds in the Pacific Northwest as late as the 1920s, but then they disappeared. Ornithologists still don't know why. The black-billed cuckoo is a more northerly species, living in dense woodland, even conifer forests. Cuckoos perch quietly and scan their surroundings for food. Hairy tent caterpillars, shunned by most birds, are often on their meal ticket. So, if you have an infestation of tent caterpillars, you might see one of these slender brown and white birds with long white-spotted tails. The cuckoo plucks a caterpillar from its tent and manipulates it back and forth in its bill, taking off many of the bothersome hairs. But some of them remain, and cuckoo stomachs are sometimes lined with these hairs. When the hairs are dense enough to prevent digestion, the entire stomach lining is cast off and regurgitated. Nature finds surprising ways to deal with problems. For BirdNote, I'm Mary McCann.
Sequoia Ezekwe for Ear to the Streets of Portland on the best community radio station on the planet, KBOO Community Radio, KBOO Portland.